Now and Again is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage, Keanu, and more, head on over to cageclub.me. That is cageclub.me. Hey everyone, it's your friendly neighborhood podcaster here. Just doing some admin right at the front before we complete the Joe trilogy. We are still looking for requests for the retro episodes of Now and Again. Your song can be selected. All you need to do is write into the mailbag at nowandagaincast@gmail.com. with any kind of comment or commentary on a song we have previously done on an episode. Add on the name of the song from 1999 or 1998 that you would like to hear us cover. Please make sure it was a single that got some radio play at the time. And usually this goes in the outro, but the one other thing you could do that would be huge for the show, if you like us, leave a review on iTunes. It's one of the biggest ways we can get out there to people who normally wouldn't, like, read my Facebook or Twitter or something like that. All right, that's enough of me. Let's go on to me with Joe.
Please play this song on the radio. Please play this song on the radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the program. This is Now and Again, Volume 7, Side B. With me right now, he is the flavor of the week. It's Joe Bruno.
Hi. That's the nicest thing that anyone ever said about me this week.
How are you?
Doing well. Day of yard work and a beer afterwards, and I could talk about some favorite songs and some very favorite not songs.
So if you had to pick real fast, stronger side, side A or side B, not counting the omissions that we'll get to. Kind of just asking if you like the pop or the rock more here.
So side A is really phenomenal, especially with the Destiny's Child we talked about, but you know, I could probably,
it's kind of front loaded.
Yeah, but I think that with everything that we have went through already, A side.
Interesting. Okay, I think this is like maybe the strongest block of rock music on a Now so far.
Yeah,
but we'll get into that. But we're not going to start with rock. We're going to jump right into it and start with Britney Spears with Don't Let Me Be the Last to Know.
Oh, man.
I'm curious how you feel about this song. I didn't know this song when we started, and I don't think it's that bad. I think I'm almost leaning towards it's good, but it's just a weird song.
It's not what I like out of Britney, so... This was, you know, this is after Oops, I Did It Again. I think it's the same album, actually.
I think it is.
And I really like pop in it because it's bouncy and it makes me want to stand up and move and smile and dance. This is kind of a, I don't want to say a bummer song, but it's a pop ballads are not really my thing. They don't really catch me the same way. They don't stick into my head like I want pop music to.
Yeah, I get that. And every band kind of needs their ballad. Every album needs a ballad or two. And I never love when they're a single. I mean, unless you're like Adele, where every song is a ballad.
Yeah.
This song, it doesn't sound like a Britney Spears song. I don't know what it sounds like, other than someone singing over like a MIDI. Her voice is really on here. Like, it plays really well to her voice, which has never been as strong as like Christina's. And it's kind of got that nasal quality. Somehow I just think it all works really well here. Except those shooby doops in the background.
yeah, aside from her doo-wop tendency here. Yeah, I think if there was a stronger vocalist on it, it could have been better. Maybe Christina, but maybe not.
I think she would have overdone it, honestly.
Oh, probably with the all the vibrato that she really likes to throw into every song she does. But that's fine. Britney's kind of like, she doesn't have that big vocal range. It doesn't make me want to sing along with her. It's kind of, I sang this song and recorded it by myself. I wouldn't say that, you know, not to say that I'm as good a singer as Ms. Spears, but I would have the same lack of range. Britney's an amazing dancer and a phenomenal performer. And, you know, if you're going to do something really well, you know, stick to your strengths. You know, it was nice to try and branch out and do a love song, but this was something that maybe somebody else could have done, probably a little bit better. Good try, but like, stick with the pop. You're really great at it.
I guess I'm also comparing it directly to some of her other ballads that I've dabbled in or we've had on the show, which include like Sometimes, Lucky, and like From the Bottom of My Broken Heart. These are like singles that were just bad ballads. This rises above that a little. There's just a sense of fun to this song where those bland, maudlin, nothing pop ballads, like a high school talent show kind of ballads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't say anything to add to that because it's talent show ballad sounds like a really good description of it. I think in, was it 10, 12 years from now, Adele could cover the song and make it beautiful.
Yeah, I don't know. See, I'm thinking this is like this is exactly where Brit's wheelhouse. If she has to do ballads, this is what it should be. Less Every Time, though. Every Time is an incredible song, but that's entirely tied to my love of Spring Breakers.
I wonder if I always wonder when it comes to album compilation, how you design an album. If you always think about the tour and how you're going to perform everything, because if this is one of those things where it's going to be a break in between the songs where she's got a huge coordinated dance to, really exhaustive routine, and then she sings this one song, or more likely, you know, half sings, half syncs it, and she gets to rest for a song, and then jump back into the next thing.
Right. Well, I imagine that when they're constructing a pop album, like, they know that there's going to be a ballad in there, and I'm sure they're thinking about singles before they're thinking about tours. But yeah, this is definitely the kind of song where, like, the dancers all leave the stage, the lighting gets dim, she moves out towards the audience, and then it's just her, and she's singing this.
If this was a rock show, it would be an acoustic song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think there was a whole lot. I mean, aside from a lot of great shots in the video of Ms. Spears and most of her skin, aside from that, there wasn't a whole lot to drum either.
Yeah, the video is kind of Blue Lagoon thing, didn't do much for me other than Brit's copious side boob.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's true story.
Copious side boob is the name of my Perez Hilton-like celebrity blog, FYI.
And painted on jean shorts.
I mean, if we want to talk about really bad ballads, let's just jump right into NSYNC's This I Promise You.
Another, like, my favorite boy bands disappointed me very hard on this album. I like Backstreet Boys, and NSYNC was they did, like, I think we talked about it last time, they took over the Backstreet Boys kind of theme of being very lovey-dovey.
Yeah, they ran into each other during a lightning storm in Freaky Friday, and NSYNC got the really terrible ballad, and Backstreet Boys got the fuck song, but, like, both of them are real bad, and they can't pull that off, and actually, the call is just bad enough that I don't even think NSYNC could save that, but this is probably bad enough that I'm not sure the Backstreet Boys would really save it either.
I don't think so either, and especially when I forgot how little chin hair Justin Timberlake can really grow.
Oh my god, chin pubes is totally a note that I have.
It was unreal. I was like, wow, I have a student in my class right now, and that's the best he can do.
And look how much he's grown up. I have the Oscars on in the background, and we're going to date the episode for sure. He just opened the Oscars with, like, I can't hear it. Maybe it was good, but with a song and dance number. Like, would you have thought in 2001 that the guy in this very 2000s brown turtleneck sweater with the chin pubes would be married to Jessica Biel and opening the Oscars?
Based on This I Promise You, I would assume they'd all be doing cocaine.
They'd all be fat and doing coke. Yeah,
except
that's
Joey
where
Fatone.
They
that guy definitely has an uncle who runs a trucking business. You know what I mean?
Oh, man, this video is 2000s as hell. Remember those sweaters? I definitely wore those sweaters. Yeah, at this point, like in eighth grade. At this point, I was a little too punk. But like eighth grade me definitely wore those sweaters.
The rip-off Scottish sweaters?
Is that what they are?
They look kind of like a British sweater, but bad.
It's very bad.
But it's almost coordinated. In the one scene at, you know, a minute and 27, you see the three gentlemen who are singing up front with the sweaters, and then there's the jacket crew in the back.
And they've got
the red jacket, the tan jacket, and so this is a very, very staged. I mean, everything NSYNC has always done is very staged and coordinated and controlled,
sure.
Which is kind of nice, and they can follow a routine very beautifully. But this video was, it didn't show off that they're real skills.
This song is like someone took Boys to Men's I Swear and was like, how can we make this way more white? That's what this song is. It's made for really boring wedding first dances.
In the video, the scenes that flash through in the bubble that passes by makes it seem like it was made for a bad movie.
Yeah, like Julia Stiles should be in this video somewhere with clips from her new movie.
Yeah, or like some rom-com. They wrote it for the rom-com, got the commission, and okay, well, we don't know what to do with this video. Got it. Green screen.
Yeah, this isn't a good song. This is the first time NSYNC has really let me down. So there's a scene at the end of this where they're eating some food, and one of them is facing the camera, so you can't see what he's drinking. But you can see that Lance Bass and Joey are drinking either iced teas or Cokes. Chris Kirkpatrick is drinking some sort of red Kool-Aid-esque drink, yes. And Justin Timberlake gets a fucking chocolate milkshake. That sums up this band so well.
The well-defined roles. One of you is a child.
Oh, I more meant like the amount of money they're going to spend on these people. Like what?
Oh,
you get tap water, you get a milkshake.
Oh yeah, this is good foreshadowing. That's a good catch. Good catch.
I mean, this was always going to be Justin Timberlake's band, though.
Timberlake, you find out, is really just all the talent compressed into all those tight Jerry curls.
He does have those tight curls here. Yeah, him and I guess it's JC. They always do kind of the verse stuff, and the other guys do the harmonies. And on side A, I realized that I said that I think the Backstreet Boys had tighter harmonies than NSYNC. And I think if there's one thing about this song I would like to give it credit for is the really tight harmonies. And I think I was just wrong and would like to take that statement back, because NSYNC does really kill it on the harmonies here. But like, harmony stuff doesn't do anything for me. You won't hear me talking about a cappella. Like, I don't know.
Pop's meant to be heard over the radio, so you're not always going to get the highest quality.
True.
I want to hear a song that I can catch and sticks in my head.
Yeah, exactly. If there's not a good hook, then I'm not as into it, especially on these albums and on pop radio. I'm completely with you there.
Speaking of completely forgettable.
Well, yeah, let's dive into S Club 7's Never Had a Dream Come True.
This is so bad, it makes me giggle every time I watch the first 4 seconds of the video and hear the first refrain. It's...
So I think it's worth talking about what this band is. They were just kind of slapped together by the Spice Girls manager, and then given a BBC children's series, and that show was supposed to like springboard them as a band. And I guess it did in other countries. Britain's weird like that. But wow. I certainly had never heard of... Nico, I'm sure, is listening to this and going, no, and it wants to scream his multi-part Wikipedia entry that he's got in his head about this band. But I'd never heard of S Club 7.
No, not even a little bit. You said it. The Spice Club manager, and this presented that same way where, like, look, we're friends. And they're just... You can almost tell it's a ripoff right away. Except they're just a boring ripoff.
Well, they also, there's something interesting here that they tried to do, which is have it be a co-ed pop band, but you can't even hear the guys in the mix on this song, and they're just they look like they wandered on set and just got caught in a couple of shots.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was actually a co-ed pop band because I couldn't really hear them in it at all. But I thought they were backup dancers at first. But if they're a part of the band, that's news. That's news.
Yeah, they are part of the band.
But it's this kind of song and this like very stereotypical, very cookie cutter, quickly thrown together garbage that turned me away from pop music for a really long time. Made me like really hate it and really dislike myself for being so drawn to it for so long. You know, the closet pop fans. We all. Are from young. It's this kind of stuff that you hear and you're just like, oh, I can't believe this is making radio play and why is this popular and I hate it. This made me turn away from pop for a long time. Not specifically S Club 7. You don't have that much power over me. I'm an independent man.
You made a point that I'd never thought of that is just absolutely fantastic. Between the fact that I was getting to this kind of age where this kind of music wasn't cool to me, but at the same time, what was crossing with that was that this music was just very much not for me. Like, Michael Jackson, you think about, like, he never was targeted, marketed towards a certain demographic. Michael Jackson was for, and remains for, everyone. So, yeah, it's something you bring up that I never, ever thought of. What pulled me away from pop music for so long was that combination of being 14 and a shithead. And also just pop music not being for me at all. And yeah, that's a great point. And it's why it took me a long time to circle back around to it.
But what drives me nuts is that checking out S Club 7, they're on a reunion tour this past last year.
Yeah, they didn't last long. They broke up in 2003. And yeah, of course. Well, when there's seven, how many do you really need for a reunion? Like, you need four people to say yes and you can call it a reunion?
It's like the old Guns N' Roses reunion tours that didn't have Slash.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is, you know, like you said, when you're the worst version of yourself at 14, 13, 15 years old, you know, you lash against stuff that you think is bullshit. This is one of those things. It was given to you by the people from the studio saying, this is pop music. And the first thing you want to say is, fuck you.
Yeah, I definitely, there's a reason that, like, Elvis Costello's Radio, like, as even though that was 25 years old and, like, you know, I'd gotten to Elvis Costello about this time, like, that song definitely resonated to me because it was just about how, like, music is aggressively anti-consumer and certainly not every, like, consumer, but certainly for me, that made a lot of sense at the time. And yeah, it did take me away from pop music for a really long time. I will say, if I have to say one good thing about this song, which I sometimes try to, the first girl, her verse, she has a really good voice and is probably better than this band. But
the one singing, right? What I think the only one singing is?
Oh, is there only one person doing the lead? I thought maybe they split it, but yeah, I guess the lead singer.
It looks like girl. It, yeah.
Yeah, she's like fine-ish. Man, this video was made for about $12.
Well, you can't really tell what the quality was because there's too much lens flare to actually see if anything's real or not.
This is, yeah, and there's stuff that's out of focus. The lens flare, Jesus Christ. It's there's in front of a white screen that they, I mean, you never know with YouTube because music videos from this time weren't like, they didn't keep them in like 720 and 1080. Like, when you're trying to find these videos now, they're just such shit quality. But I don't think, there's times when it looks like someone smeared Vaseline on the lens. Like, is this an ugly,
yeah,
ugly video?
It just zooms out of focus. Yeah. They're behind a waterfall or they're in a harbor, something shimmering.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not the quality of anything else.
It's a rejected Casey and JoJo B-side, it feels like, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, like, I feel like...
A bad Casey JoJo song.
I feel like they could have carried this kind of song better. It's very much in their wheelhouse. Straight down to that terrible key change at the end.
Ugh, yeah.
Well, that's kind of the end of the pure pop on Now Volume 7. And, you know, I kind of hinted at a fairly strong rock section. Looking at it now, yeah. It's like, that's such great heights because I would only say that there's two good songs and like one okay. And then let's just get right into it with a song that I just tweeted, Sorry Not Sorry. I fucking love this song. It's Lifehouse, Hanging by a Moment.
Oh, this is one of the best songs ever made.
I don't know if I would go that far, but it's certainly one of the best songs from 2001 and maybe the first half of... I mean, I guess I don't exactly know what came out in 2000, but in the 2000s, but I would guess this is number one for me of 2001 and would probably end up in my top 10 or top 20 of the entire decade.
I've sang karaoke with you 3 times, and every time
really?
You always make sure this is one of your karaoke songs.
Yeah, the guy's voice is in my range.
And it, well, not even as in a range, but karaoke especially is not one of those things like, you've seen me at karaoke. I am not what you'd call a talented singer, but
stop. I've heard you do some Casey and JoJo. You do it better than S Club 7.
Good. So C-Clad, so B-side reject album of Casey JoJo. Got it.
Yeah.
But the songs that make you feel things is what you want to sing to people.
Right.
Or even, you know, four groups of friends in a closed room so no one else can hear you. But, you know, Lifehouse, it's an absolutely amazing song. And after S Club 7, a breath of fresh air.
This guy's voice is a little close to that underbite kind of rock, but he doesn't go full Vedder.
I like how you mentioned not full Vedder. I think that's my new favorite phrase to describe a vocal sound.
Yeah, you never go full Vedder. You hear me, Creed guy?
You can't do all vowels. Most vowels, not all vowel.
Let's get the video out of the way. There's nothing to it. It's just a performance video. Nothing there. This band, surprisingly, this band is still together, still performing, and still relatively successful in 2017. So good for them.
Yeah, I just read that up doing research that they've had 6 albums since?
Yeah, what? And they're One of them was like the biggest independent album of the year not too long ago, which is good for them, I guess.
It's amazing. I think when I was reading about the song, the lead singer, I forget his name, he said he wrote it in about 5 minutes. And the way he described the writing process, where it just kind of came to him, he wrote it down and worked at the song and made it happen. It was described as like capital R romantic poetry. You know how those old romantic poets would do it? They would get that in divine inspiration and they would write it down like that old Kubla Khan poem. He just came to him one night and he just did it. You know, it almost seems like something like this was serendipitous to him. And that's magic.
And there's something to that. I tend to laugh when that's attributed to a pop song, but
well, the way he described it was, it made it sound like it was, you know, he definitely studied what romantic poetry was, capital R.
Sure. Lifehouse knows how to write a song, for sure. This song is constantly driving and building. Like, it's got the low part, and then a louder part, and then a harder part, and then a louder part, and then back down, and back up again. Like, that's a perfect rock song that keeps you entertained for all, and 3 minutes and 30 seconds. You're in, you're out. Perfect. Love it.
It's great. It made for radio play. You want to sing it. You want to sing it all the time. Mm-hmm. And it starts, like you said, it starts off really low and engages you right away. You know, it starts with that do 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 do. Mm-hmm. It hits a chord in your heart, and it stays inside you for a long time. And I forgot that this came out so long ago, because when I hear it, whether it's on my own playlists or on what is now going to be like classic rock stations, it's going to be, it feels more new.
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily feels super 2001 or 2000. Like, it's not like She Likes Me for Me or something like that, where that's like clearly 1998 or whatever, or bust. This song definitely, I don't know if it sounds exactly like it comes out today because rock is dead, but like, yeah, it definitely doesn't sound like some of its contemporaries.
Yeah, no, but this was a breath of fresh air, and I did not know that this was on a Now album, not even a little bit.
Now is certainly not known for its rock segments, but this song, it's hard to keep heaping praise on it because, like I said before, I think the song really speaks for itself. I think a lot of people do remember this song. I do like his vocal performance a lot. There's a lot of energy, especially like we're talking about how that song keeps building. Like when it kicks into that chorus from the really quiet bridge, his voice is pretty stellar.
I don't have much bad to say about it. I mean, the video, I like performance videos. I mean, it's what you want from a rock. It's what I like from a rock band. I want to see you guys playing instruments because that's what makes you different than the other actual just performers on this album. I like this song very, very much. But I can't believe they've had 6 albums since. That still blows me away, and I'm so excited to try and listen to them.
Yeah, now that we've got Spotify, there's like no barrier to just seeing like if Lifehouse is good beyond this song. So if I remember to do it, maybe I'll do that.
Yeah, I agree. Speaking of rock being dead.
Well, speaking of bands that have been around for fucking ever.
There are bedroom sets in America that are older than Aerosmith, but I don't think many.
Yeah, this is Aerosmith's Jaded. We are definitely in this point in their career where, like, there was a big turn. I think it probably came with one of them going to rehab. I don't know if that's for sure, but I'm going to bet it did.
Where so they turned from 87. Being... In 87, yeah. One of them went to rehab, and slowly they all eventually got to rehab and came out clean. But that was like, you know, that was after their really terrible album.
Oh, you're not joking. That's actual fact?
Yeah, about 87. Yeah,
I thought you were 90. Just riffing with me.
No, they actually stopped the drugs.
There's some Aerosmith I like and there's some I don't. Some of their early stuff is really good, like Dream On, obviously. Their cover of Come Together, no thank you. But there's a lot of that older stuff, Toys in the Attic era, that is really, really good. And then, yeah, like you said, they kind of just did, like, they kind of disappeared. I guess maybe this is around the time they were doing, like, Janie's Got a Gun and Love in an Elevator. Because after that, they come back with like the album that's all the videos are about how much he wants to fuck his daughter. And it's like he's kind of mom rock at that point. Like Aerosmith like put on their dad jeans and got real soft.
So the story for Aerosmith is they all went to rehab and it was, I think, 2 albums after Toys in the Attic, because that was the most, that was amazing, you know. Toys in the Attic, phenomenal. And then they got Garbage and Garbage. rock back in the day. You would tour, you'd do drugs, you'd have sex with lots of people, and then you would just slowly die. And then eventually, you know, I think it was their manager or somebody convinced them to start going to rehab one at a time, going to rehab. And then once they got clean, I saw an interview with them and said the music was so much better because that's, you know, behavior-wise, you replace one behavior for another. Some people who go to rehab, they come out, they're super into sports, they follow stats like crazy. Some people are really into their hobbies, but it's just behavior replacement. If you're really into drugs, then all you've got is music. You're going to make music, not to say that it's going to be great music, but I think mom rock's a really good way of it.
Yeah, and here's the thing. I think this is the least offensive of that post-rehab Aerosmith era. Like, I know we were recently at a karaoke event where a lot of people were excited to do I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, which, no thank you. But this is certainly better than...
Who doesn't like that movie, though?
That's true. That is a pretty fun movie. That album... no, not that album, sorry. Pink, that's a bad song, but I remember that album, I think it was called Nine Lives, was actually pretty decent. And then this is, yeah, of all their singles after that, this is probably the least offensive. It's got a fun riff. His voice is always been pretty on, even if I don't love it.
So as Aerosmith got, you know, less and less popular, as rock started to slowly, slowly die and die and die, even through the 80s and early 90s, what brought Aerosmith back from the dead was Run DMC.
Yes,
and,
of course.
Just Push Walk This Way.
Yep.
That collaboration shot them back into like, oh, that's right, this is an American band. It isn't America, absolutely. The best thing in the world. But this song came out, I think it was a year. The earlier this year, they performed at the Super Bowl. And then
2001. Yes, yes. Yeah. It was them and NSYNC and Britney Spears, right?
Mm-hmm. And with a bunch of collaborations, which is, I guess at this point, became Aerosmith's bread and butter. To keep them, you know, in people's faces.
Sure.
But this is, like you said, perfect. You know, it's quintessential Aerosmith. It's the shittier version of it's a clean, polished Guns N' Roses that mom's okay with.
Yeah, it's like how you get a lot of if you watch interviews with older horror movie directors like John Carpenter or Wes Craven, rest in peace. They'll all say like, man, I never would have, now that I'm a dad, I never would have made Last House on the Left, or I never would have made Assault on Precinct 13. I feel like that's just kind of their like post-dad, like they're all grown up and they're making stuff that, then again, I mean, maybe that's not true because like I said, that whole, I don't remember what album it was, but where it had like Crying and Crazy, like all of those videos were real creepy towards Liv Tyler. So maybe I'm not, they're seeing this quite correctly.
But some of the lyrics he says, the refrain, I'm the one that jaded you. The next one he changes to, I'm the one, I'm afraid of you.
Yeah.
You know, you can tell, like, he's trying his best to throw himself into this, you know, lyrical world, ruining women. And probably a lot of things that he, you know, these might be autobiographical things. Because I assume if you've been in the rock scene for this long, you've done some pretty terrible things.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
So if you've jaded women, this is not a bad thing. If you think you've been the bad guy before, this is, I wouldn't say an anthem for it because there's better songs, but it's not bad. I like, they've been everything since they've gone out of rehab. They've been consistently okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of their last gasp. Their next album, which is called Honkin' on Bobo, no one knows
true,
what that is.
True American classic.
Yeah,
the American Renaissance is alive and well.
Yeah, it's it goes Exile on Main Street, Who's Next, and Honkin' on Bobo. But I mean, speaking of bands like that, like a lot of their contemporaries aren't making hits in 2001. We kind of talked about that on the show when Bon Jovi came back with It's My Life. Like, they still were around, and that's pretty impressive. Granted, like, they're doing a lot of collaborations. They're not writing as much of their own stuff. Like, very famously, I Don't Want to Miss a Thing was written by Linda Perry. But, I mean, okay, they're doing what they have to do to stay relevant, and you can't fault them for that.
Yeah, I mean, when you got to pay alimony, or you have dependents to do, you do what you got to do to pay the mortgage. And while, you know, people who grew up on rock like us, we're like, you know, fuck the man. You do love for love of music. That's not really feasible. This is your profession,
right?
You know, and like I said before, you know, we fault Nickelback, but they're one of the highest paying bands currently, and they know what they're doing in this business. And if Aerosmith is, you know, a worker, a cog in this business, they're doing it really well.
I would take Aerosmith any era over Nickelback, to be honest with you.
I agree, except when you mash up a bunch of Nickelback songs to that one drum line.
Yeah, they're all exactly the same. So I imagine we're gonna have similar stories or anecdotes here, but like, did you have experience with Aerosmith from a young age?
Oh yeah, so my parents, I grew up with records in the basement, and my dad was a Deadhead. Grew up with Led Zeppelin albums. My mom was huge into Elvis, and not as much Michael Jackson, but you know, heard on the radio. But I mean, the R&B, blues, you know, that old rock and roll kind of stuff. And my aunt, who was younger than my mother, was really into the Rolling Stones and Aerosmith, that kind of era, rock and hair band, Def Leppard, all that jazz. So I've been surrounded by it. And Toys in the Attic was, I thought, one of the best things I ever heard in my life, right, up until I heard other music. But, you know, I had that on record, and it was, ooh, good.
Yeah, there's a point in your life where you really only like your parents' music. Like, yeah, it comes right before it's just, like, anything that's on the radio. And my dad was big into Aerosmith. I would guess, like, he would probably say it's in his top five favorite bands of all time, just from, like, where he's, well, like, bands I know he's gone to see either as an adult or in his youth, things he still listens to. Yeah, it's weird what my dad liked and what he didn't in regards to classic rock. Didn't like Bowie, didn't like Fleetwood Mac, but loved, like, Aerosmith and The Who, and then, like, weird, like, super dad rock bands like Nazareth and Foghat and, like,
I like
fucking
that one.
Montrose.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
So my dad was into most everything, so if you could, I think if it was on the radio, my dad would listen to it or play it. Bands he's seen, I think, depended on who was playing where and how he would get there.
Yeah.
You know, so he was in, like, he had never really bought many tickets, but he knew people, like, who's going to be going? I know he told me, I just heard this first story. We went to see Blondie somewhere in New York City. And I was like, what the, you saw Blondie? Like, yeah, it was a good show. Like, are you fucking kidding me? That's one of the, of course it's a great show. It's Blondie.
Yeah, I've definitely heard them, my dad and his brothers tell stories about, like, finding out, like, Zeppelin tickets for their American tour went on sale, and they grew up in Bayonne, and, like, just flying to like, Madison Square Garden at, like, midnight, just to, when they found out that they were going on sale.
Yeah, so my dad was really into Led Zeppelin, once I found out how Led Zeppelin worked, was surprising, because they never got radio play.
Really?
They didn't get a lot of radio play because they, you know, they always released these, you know, long 5-minute songs, four and a half minute songs. And at the time, you did like 3 minutes. That's your spot. And there's, and you know, Led Zeppelin was like, you know, blow me. So they got big by word of mouth, and then eventually radios would play them just because people, once they found they had a following. But they didn't get big on the radio. They got big through word of mouth and touring.
I guess that makes sense, sir.
So I was surprised that my dad was really into them. And when you're a young kid, you can't distinguish, you know, different bands always that well. So Aerosmith was kind of like Led Zeppelin because there were guys singing in a microphone with guitar. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have other stuff like the softer Guns N' Roses. But you always, you know, I had the full gradient, and my dad liked Aerosmith. But I don't think he was ever – he's a big fan of Toys in the Attic and the stuff you hear on the radio. And then – I don't want to miss a thing because he's a huge fan of Ben Affleck and Armageddon.
My dad had all the albums, I think, up until – I don't think he had this one. I think that's how I knew about Nine Lives. That's the one before that. I think it was one of those albums that I latched onto at like the 6th, 7th grade. Like, I can listen to an album age. Steven Tyler's voice is like very unique. Like, it's always – all of those bands that have persisted really do have something that sets them apart, you know, whether it's – the vocalist, and, you know, kind of the case of this band or Led Zeppelin, like an incredible guitarist, an amazing drummer, like this, all those bands really did have something that set them apart from all of the other ones, which is why, like, those, like Nazareth and, like, those other dad rock bands, like, no one knows who the fuck they are anymore. And you hear that voice, and, I mean,
he's all in every time. Every word he says, he is all in.
Even in Skittles commercials. That commercial is a living nightmare. Steven Tyler looks like a living nightmare. Like, he looks like a melting wax figure of himself these days.
So the best part of Aerosmith, I think, is trying to figure out how big his mouth really is relative to his head.
Oh my god. Okay, so the first comment on this YouTube video is, you can put a coconut in Steven Tyler's mouth and still have room for a pineapple.
Yes. And right after that is Mila Kunis, which, you know, is undiscussed up until now. Yeah. Like, hey, that's she. I, how many things has she been in?
By this time, probably just the 70s show.
Which she got onto, not illegally, but when she was like 15.
Yeah, she was very young. She's doing, there's doing like an Alice in Wonderland thing here. Video is pretty cool. You could see that Aerosmith is still pulling in some video budget, which is cool.
Sure. I mean, they'll get play and people will see them. And if you can get 20-somethings, watch 20-somethings, 30-somethings watching MTV, hey, there you go.
Yeah, this song definitely, I expected to hate it because I was thinking of, you know, like Crazy and Pink and things that don't want to miss a thing. This is definitely better than all of those. It's not the Aerosmith that a lot of people remember, like Dream On era, but I mean, everyone kind of knew that they flipped the switch at a certain point.
Yeah, this is good Aerosmith, and good's one of my favorite words for describing things like music because it describes everything below great and above bad.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm with you on that one. Man, all right, so we're going from like a well-established classic rock band to a band whose, this song doesn't even have a Wikipedia entry. It's Evan and Jaren from My Head to My Heart.
This album is swinging me because I get these, you have these like, Lifehouse and Aerosmith and then Evan and Jaren, but then before there was SCUMM7, I'm like, I'm so all over the place and like, oh, geez, I don't know how I feel is swinging one way or another. Is every now such an emotional roller coaster when you listen to it?
100%. There are big ups and downs. It's like the worst roller coaster ever.
I think I might make these my like playlist to watch just to get myself amped up to do things. So Evan and Jaren, I had to do some real research on this because I never heard this song before. Not a bad. Not it's not the worst song on this album, SCUMM7, but I think I did know that they were the same twin duo that did Crazy for This Girl.
Yes, as we spoke about with Chris on the last episode, we did do Crazy for This Girl. He remembered that song. I had no recollection of that song.
I remember that song, but I had no idea. If you asked me, never in 1 million years and 10 choices would I have guessed Evan and Jaren.
No. They look so... I joked in the last episode that they looked like the leads of Supernatural, and they really look like the leads of Supernatural in this video. It's freaky.
Especially being twins.
Yeah. This song sounds like it should be in a movie about a fake band. Mm-hmm. It's very like that thing you do-ish. Like, this isn't the lead song. This isn't that thing you do. But it's like the one that plays during a touring montage or something like that.
And it's funny you say montage because this song was used in Runaway Bride.
Really?
Yeah, they use this in Runaway Bride. And if I remember that correctly, that's one of my mother loves that movie. So it's probably a terrible, sappy, romantic movie.
Yeah, and that's where this fits.
It's not a bad song. Again, the word good is so subjective.
Right.
I mean, everything.
This is a competent song played by people who can sing. That doesn't mean I will remember this song for more than 10 seconds after I finish editing this episode.
Yeah, exactly right. It's kind of like Aerosmith's Jaded. It's okay. Yeah, it's all right. You know, maybe you guys aren't going to be superstars, but you can write a song. You can sing a song. These guys would crush karaoke, or they would have America's Got Talent nowadays.
Yeah, they've got that clean cutness to them that execs love and want to sign, but then have no idea what to do with.
Do you think that these guys would be much bigger in like the 60s or 70s? Maybe we were trying to do like Beatles ripoffs?
Oh, 100%. These two would be perfect in like the days of like the Monkees.
Yeah, that was the first thing I thought in my head, like the Monkees days. Yeah, they just had the unfortunate luck of being born of performing at a time when we needed new things.
Yeah, and I think that's why that thing you do kind of popped into my head, since that's kind of a both like an homage and a parody of bands of that type in that era.
That's a good thought. One of them is still playing music up until I think 2011, if I remember. He was a country music.
Oh well, yeah. I feel like country is like the recourse of like every like washed up like musician. Like hey Hootie, how's your country music career going? Surprisingly well, actually.
I mean, like you're right. It's a ho-hum. It's not the worst song. I could not listen to it ever again, and I could hear it and be okay with it.
Yep, it is completely
forgettable.
Inoffensive. Yeah, inoffensive to a degree that is almost annoying.
Like you said, it felt like the Monkees, like a 60s gimmick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if they would have been better off. Probably not. I think the answer is probably not, but just thinking out loud here, just spitballing. I wonder if they would have been better off in a band where instead of just like, hey, here's Aaron and I can't even say their name, Evan and Jaren, just them behind like a, you know, touring band, studio musicians, if like they were just in a band, you know, like if they were in a band with a dumb name and they were just part of it, I wonder if they would have been more successful.
There's no point in the song where you hear a guitar riff or a vocal solo that really demonstrates their like astounding ability. And if you've had only one hit beforehand, you want to make yourself stand out, especially in this, you know, the era of musical saturation where now is coming out every quarter.
Yeah, this song could have used a quick solo.
They could have used anything. So, yeah. And like you mentioned that, you know, the washed up country career, you know, it's, if you don't have anything you do amazingly, maybe you do country, you know? if they could do something, they would do something. I don't think they could, so they didn't. But
We might be speaking highly, quote unquote. There might be people with fondness for this song as it gets played on like a 101.5, you know?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's a good one.
If it came out in the 60s along with like on like Happy Together or something like that.
Uh-huh. This would go really well that weekend on the 101.5 when there's no talk and it's just that really bland music from that era.
Yeah, exactly.
So Evan and Jaren, right people for the wrong time.
Evan and Jaren. Let's finish off now Volume 7, last track on the album. It's American Hi-Fi's Flavor of the Week. Nintendo, I wish that I could make her see. And I will definitely call them American Wi-Fi accidentally at one point. I've been doing it all week. So I apologize in advance.
This is a wonderful song. I'm so glad this was on here.
It's a great song.
I didn't realize until I saw this video that they were mocking Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
Yeah, I love Heavy Metal Parking Lot. They do it almost shot for shot at the beginning.
Yeah, and I saw it and I was like, wait a second, I've seen this before. And I was blown away. I love the song, but I think you have much more great things to say about it.
I'm looking at what comes up from the similar bands related videos, things like that. I'm getting Yellow Card, Good Charlotte, Bowling for Soup, the Scotty Doesn't Know scene from Eurotrip, Wheatus. This is better than all of those, for sure. All American Rejects, I think they're a little bit better than like Bowling for Soup is like the absolute bottom of this kind of like early 2001 pop punk kind of nasally singer. But I think this is more at the higher end of it. This song is really good. This song has, there's a song that's coming up later in the emissions that my biggest issue with it is how self-serious it is. This is just a good fun rock song that doesn't take itself that seriously, but isn't jokey.
Yeah. I like that breakdown. That was really good. Yeah, it's pop punk, and you know, I tend to group those that lump together as you could put them on like maybe two albums and get all the good you need out of that, like Sum 41 and that kind of stuff. Just kind of lump them together. But I think categorize them is really important for this time era because American Heavy made a really good song, even though it might be the nice guy or neckbeard anthem.
Yeah, it's about the girl who's longing though. It's about the girl is in the position of being the one who has the unrequited love, kind of, though. The girl's the nice guy in this video, or in this song, which is an interesting little turn that I didn't even think about.
I don't see that. The lyrics go, your boyfriend doesn't know anything about her.
No, it's She's her boyfriend. He's saying, like she knows all his favorite songs, and she knows everything about him, and he's out screwing other girls.
Oh, so it's her point of indecision where that is she just the flavor of the week?
She's getting cucked.
Oh,
as the frogs on the internet say these days.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's That's better. That's a better perspective, because I was listening to it. I was like, oh no, come on. This was so good for a while. Why has it got to be like that?
Yeah, no, it doesn't go. It doesn't go full Backstreet Boys or anything like that. They also do the "Here I Go Again on My Own" thing in the middle of the video with the girl dancing on the car.
Yep,
they know their homages pretty well. It's a good video, good song.
They did great to metal. I mean, you know, heavy metal band that was about Judas Priest, I think.
That sounds right. Yeah, they got a guy in the parking lot who looks like he's dressed like Dee Snider. They definitely hit their. It's weird how all these pop punk bands had a lot of love for like that 80s metal, because Sum 41 also clearly, like, they shout out Maiden and Priest in Fat Lip and stuff like that.
Yeah, something had to come before you. Everyone listened to something before, and we all listened to the Beatles, you know? So it all comes from something. Yeah, and especially my favorite part of the heavy metal white suburban American homages of the Firebirds and the Trans Am.
Yes, yeah, the cars are perfect. Even the filter on the camera filter that they're doing is great.
The bleached out white.
Yeah, this just I don't know if it's the best video that we've done on Now and Again, but I think it's my favorite so far.
I think I like this video in terms of a performance video a lot better than I do Lifehouses, because you see the band, they're playing and it's great, but you get more story and you get more meaning from the song from it. Like, you see the girl, she does get betrayed at the end, and I would have loved to see Lifehouse's interpretation of their own song, what they would have brought to screen, instead of leaving it entirely up to me. This was great. It brought me on a path and a story and a journey. It was better than just a performance video.
Yep. Chorus, like, again, going back to Lifehouse, even Jaded, I love choruses that, like, the song just takes, like, a second, and then, bam, chorus. Like, Lifehouse does that. Aerosmith, they do that little pause before he goes into the My My Baby Blue. This doesn't take a pause so much as it has that those gaps with that call and response almost of the chorus with the he's too stoned. And, like, if at karaoke or at a show, everyone's going to sing that. Also, I definitely heard this song on the radio, and we were talking about how they censored out Nelly talking about smoking an L. I'm pretty sure Too Stoned was not censored out on white radio. So,
absolutely not. Well, I mean, you can, of course, because, you know, a white guy talking about Too Stoned, maybe he's talking about something different, and it's not that fat, it's not part of the lifestyle.
Right, of course.
But, I mean, it's just racism.
Yeah, you know, that's what it comes down 100%. To. Little Nintendo shout-out. They're fun lyrics. The song doesn't take itself seriously, but like I said, it's not a gag song like some of Blink-182 songs or something like that.
He does say Nintendo, right? I was just gonna say, because I thought it was Nintendo. I wrote it down, erased it, and I was like, no, there's no way he said that, did he? Okay,
oh, and it's got a solo. You're asking for a solo. It's got a solo.
Gotcha.
A pretty good one.
Oh, yeah,
fine one.
Gotta have a solo. If you're gonna do a heavy metal homage, you gotta have a solo.
Yeah, you gotta have a girl dancing on a car, and you gotta have a solo.
And leopard print. Much leopard print.
Definitely leopard print.
but it was a great song, and it was a good one. I like it a lot. I never saw the video before, and I'm still giggly after seeing its homage or parody of heavy metal. I love it.
I love the scene where he's doing it comes when he's doing the Too Stoned line over and over again at the end of the bridge, another, you know, which is a great part, where it shows each person, like, the video is focused on. It shows the lead singer of the band. It shows the girl who's getting betrayed. It shows the guy who's doing the betraying. And then it just shows one random guy in the parking lot throwing up the horns and flicking his tongue in and out.
That's the guy with the Confederate shirt on, right?
It's so good.
Wonderful. Very metal. Yeah. Very just metal and fuck you.
You can have your tongue in your cheek without being a bunch of dumb jokes, and I really appreciate that. You know, Blink-182 is the band that kind of set themselves out from all of these guys, but maybe that wasn't right. Maybe it should have been American Hi-Fi. Maybe this is like a redemption for them. I mean, I don't know what the rest of their songs are.
I want to hear more instrumental stuff. I think Blink-182 had a lot of talent behind all their silliness, and I want to see if American Hi-Fi has got more. I would love to hear if this is the middle or worst of American Hi-Fi. I would have loved to hear more of them.
Yeah. You know, them and Lifehouse. Maybe I've said this about Harvey Danger too. Maybe when I get towards the end of this project, I'll put together a list of bands to visit and see how it kind of comes out. But this and Lifehouse would definitely go on that list.
I think that'd be a great idea to do, just because who knows what actually stymies a career. I certainly don't. That's why I don't do it.
Well, did you do any research on these guys like you did Lifehouse?
I didn't go as deep in. Good. I didn't see where they went.
Good, because let's play a quick little game. Are they still a band or not?
Ooh, American Hi-Fi? Does that mean with current members, yes or no?
Yeah, like have they released, are they still touring and have they released an album recently?
Ooh, I would say they released an album within the past 3 years.
You'd be correct. They are still a band.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Can't say I've heard anything, but...
Well, I think I trusted your judgment that they could be better than Blink, and if they stuck with it, maybe they would have made something better of it. And I think I'm going to make a note right now to check out American Hi-Fi, because popped rock songs.
Yeah.
That I could hum all day.
I mean, here's the thing. Like, I'm saying that, like, we're kind of hypothesizing, but I'm, like, I would bet a lot of money that the answer is, like, no, like, they're actually not that good if you listen to other albums. And, like, Blink maintained what they did consistently, which is probably what put them above everyone else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Consistency is a big deal, too. But I'm okay with an artist getting weird and just changing everything up, too.
Yeah, this song is good. This will always be a karaoke jam. This will always be a rock band song, kind of. It's a doozy. It's a good one. It's a great way to end Now Volume 7, which has kind of been shit.
Yeah, aside from the Destiny's Child, it's been pretty terrible.
In the words of Frank Turner, who'd have thought that after all, something as simple as rock and roll would save this Now volume? Let's go to the omissions. The first one is something that I can't believe wasn't on a Now ever. It had to be one of the biggest pop songs of the year, just based on the caliber, this Traveling Wilburys-esque pop experiment. It's Lady Marmalade, and it's Christina, Lil' Kim, Maya, Pink, a little cameo by Missy Elliott.
The cover of the All Saints song, who covered Sabrina, who covered Patti LaBelle.
So, memories of Lady Marmalade.
So my memory, this wasn't my first time I heard her, but it was my first, most people's first exposure to Lil' Kim. And, I remember hearing people, my mother especially, and my aunts and cousins saying how jarring Lil' Kim is and how, like, profane she is. And I thought, like, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
It's accepted in hip hop where it's okay for guys to do that. Well, I mean, we're all living this life. And that was one of my first early memories. And then I remember seeing it, and it was, I think, I didn't watch a lot of music videos. Mm-hmm. But what I did see is I heard this was an amazing one, and it was my first exposure to, like, an overtly sexual music video, because it's about a brothel.
Oh, yeah.
In Moulin Rouge. So it was overtly sexual. I remember that, and not thinking anything wrong about it, but it was the first one I think of that, you know, not derogatory towards it, or that it's propping up a lifestyle that may not be best for the participants. This is what we do, and this is how we are. And I thought it was, I wouldn't say revolutionary, but it turned my head on things.
Yeah, they do that because it's on the soundtrack. It was like the big song off of Moulin Rouge. So they kind of do the whole weird, like, stylized turn of the century prostitute thing, which I've never seen that movie. Is it any good?
Apparently it was very good.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
When I was looking into it, it won a bunch of awards. It was nominated for many yeah. more. So, I think I don't know if it was a musical, but I know it was successful. But I think the song was even more successful.
Yeah, it might have been.
It's still the longest reigning number one for an all-female group, all-female compilation.
Wow.
At 9 weeks.
That's impressive.
At number one. Yeah, it's a big deal. And hey, do you know this started Christina's big hair outside of this music video? Was this the start of Christina's big hair?
I think it was. She did do this style, this Dee Snider thing, for a little while. She looks like the rest of the girls look like they work at the brothel, but Christina looks like she haunts a room where one of them hung themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I'm into that.
Yeah. It's not good.
But I never seen Maya after this. I don't remember her afterwards.
She does stuff. She's around. Maya might steal the song right out from under Pink and Christina, because Pink and Christina are like, we're just going to go back and forth on our voice, and like, we're going to do dueling voices here and see who could be more powerful. And Maya's just like, I think I'm just going to perform this song really well and just kind of steal the song from both of you.
Yeah, she does a great job. Her and her and Kim are amazing on this. I mean, Pink, I didn't realize how small a part she actually had.
Yeah, she's fine in her part. I think Christina actually is probably the worst part of this song, because I think, she overperforms it. Lil' Kim does slay. You know, we were talking about Eve slaying, but Lil' Kim's real good here, too.
She's just great. She's, she really brought the boys to the yard on this one.
Yeah, and another Nintendo reference, playing the boys like Atari. Two video game references back to back.
Yeah, no, it was, so when Marmalade came out, what did you think about it? Were you in the throes of shithead teenagerness as I was?
Well, yeah, but I was also in the throes of puberty, so I loved this video.
Oh, well, okay, all right, that goes without saying. But I remember this song stuck around for a long time, even after it wasn't number one, just years, radio play, years later, and I would hear it again, and I was always happy to hear it.
Yeah, it's a really good song.
As I grew up, I became more and more a fan of like collaborations amongst artists, and hearing different voices and things going back and forth. I'm starting to realize that that's one of my favorite things about the industry, is that you can do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, the supergroup concept, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Like Temple of the Dog, stuff that happens. Audio Slave. Even if you're... Yes. Even just collaborations, if you're two artists who happen to like working together, same label, like parent label, whatever, they get together, like that Ariana Grande with Nicki Minaj and Iggy Azalea, I think.
Sure.
Or that
I won't pretend that I'm up on the current pop. We'll get there,
Oh, well, but regardless, like, they collaborate, they do one song together, and it's the best they both do, like, that quarter. No matter what.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You know, it takes two heads can work together well if you just let each other work. And I think I never really thought of Christina Aguilera as overperforming until you said it, but I think I see it.
Yeah,
now.
And that's really kind of her thing. It works in her own music most of the time, but it gets grating. According to Nico, mentioned this on an episode where this song got brought up, that Christina and Lil Pink, like, either they're promoters, managers, themselves, their egos, there's just a big feud between the two of them, and it's the main reason why they didn't do like more songs together. Like, this could have been like a Traveling Wilburys thing, and they probably could have dropped a pretty killer album, this group, but you know, they're just in and out on this because ego. There's a related video where they do the song with Patti LaBelle, which I am very interested to watch when we are off air.
Wow, because the covering of this song just is a testament to its quality. Patti LaBelle did it. Sabrina covered it in 87. And then All Saints, who I'd never heard of before, covered it in 98. I never even knew that existed.
Yeah, me neither. We actually did All Saints were on the first episode. And then, there's a reason why they haven't been back.
They're not very nowy.
No, they're not much of anything.
But I'm a big fan of this, and still, I'm a huge fan of collaborations. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Would have liked to see also Missy Elliott do more than just say, like, the people's names. But as you kind of pointed out, this was Lil' Kim's first introduction to, like, white America. So if we had two rappers on the song...
Whoa. It's too much color. You can't brown the onion that much.
Tipper Gore would have shit her pants.
Yeah, Maya's already black, but at least she's singing. Oh, God, heaven forbid. Yeah. She does that hip-hop stuff.
Don't want to hear that rippity rap. Good song. Anything else to say about it? Yeah.
It absolutely should have been on the Now, that's for sure.
Songs that maybe shouldn't have been on the Now include, and wasn't for maybe a good reason, include Stained. It's been a while
since I could hold my head up high. And it's been a while.
Mostly this is on there because anytime the phrase "it's been a while" gets said, I do it in this voice, and this is just me giving this a reason to continue doing it.
So this... this song, I think it was the other one that came out first, right? Outside? Was that came out before It's Been a While?
I couldn't tell you a fucking thing about Stained, except they spell their name stupid. Like, this is
just... So Stained. I was a fan of Stained. Their first album I heard, it wasn't the first one, it was their second album, that had Mud Shovel on. It was very metal. I was big into metal, but the first album I ever bought for myself was Rob Zombie's Hellbilly Deluxe.
Nice.
And then, you know, in Korn's Fall of Leader. So, like, I was full in the throes of like shithead teenager metalhead. And you know, Mud Shovel on the album before this was super heavy, really fast paced and wonderful. I liked it then. This album came out with Outside and with the slower kind of vocals, and then this happened, and it was the first time I started like really listen to how an artist can struggle with something and pour himself into it. And maybe it's not a great song in terms of like how original it is, because it's an acoustic guitar and a guy talking about something he didn't like.
Right.
But I'm very sympathetic to people who do something and talk about a very personal event, you know, a lot of people go into recovery, but his struggle, he makes pretty clear. And
yeah,
maybe he bashes you over the head with it a little bit in the song.
Yeah, the lyrics are very cliched. It is his performance that carries the song as it does. And if there's one good thing to say about it is, even though I like to do his stupid voice, like, it does carry the song. This is on the omission section, because in 2001, this song spent fucking 20 weeks at number one.
Get out of town.
It was massive. And there was this kind of new metal wave happening, and these guys are definitely the softer side of the Family Values tour. And I would rather take this, and I think it holds up far better than any Limp Bizkit or Korn song ever could.
I don't know. I love them at karaoke too, though. But I think you're right. This is the way you play this, and the way you hear it is, I don't want to say less grating, but it makes you, it's easier to sing and remember instead of any kind of Limp Bizkit or Korn song, for sure.
It's 5 minutes. I think a song this self-serious and mopey can probably be cut down to like 4 at max, especially the verse where they talk about how he remembers how she tastes and asks if he can blame this on his father. Can I blame this on my father is like, that's the lyric that should only be said in like a gag song. That's not a good lyric.
No, it's of course. Well, any angsty teen's going to blame everything on their parents anyway.
Of course. Oh, it's perfect. It's very Family Values.
That's why it spoke to me in the beginning, because, you know, when you're an angsty teen, you're like, oh, fuck the parents. There's your audience grab right there.
Yeah. I can't begrudge this song. I also don't have to like it. But I get why it spent some time at number one. It was different. It was accessible to more than just, like, people who liked rock. I think this was easy for the mainstream to digest. Again, his performance is quite good. Half the year is pretty friggin' bananas.
That's way too long. I think, so another thing is, you know, plenty of people have been talking about recovery. I think these guys missed out is that Johnny Cash has been writing songs about recovery for decades and keeping them under 3 minutes.
Oh, I can guarantee you that this guy had a Johnny Cash poster on his wall, but didn't like really listen to much Johnny Cash outside of like Folsom Prison.
The Folsom? Yeah. Yeah, we just got the picture of him in Folsom Prison, and that's it.
Yeah, man, I love he was the man in black. And we're all going to wear black in our video anyway. Like, we all love Johnny Cash. Let's just do that.
Johnny was on pills too.
It's, you know, not going to change anyone's mind on this song, that's for sure. It is exactly what you remember.
Yeah, they throw in a little rock to make it sound a little bit more like a little bit more rock than they were. But this song, this album itself is, it's the one before this one, and the one after this, you can show how Stain, like, as an artist, very quickly are growing up. The one before this was angry and pissed. And
okay. I actually had that question.
And there's this one.
Were they harder on other songs and albums, or were they softer than
goodness.
This?
Oh, my goodness. So the one song you want to listen for older Stain is Mud Shovel. And that's the one that got, you know, some radio play on the rock stations. It is very heavy metal. That's what probably got them on the Family Values tour. What brought their attention to like someone like producers like Korn and stuff. So Mud Shovel was very, very heavy metal. And then this song came out, and they're struggling and sad, and they're in a low place, and they're looking up. They're looking hopeful and trying to get better. So that's what this album was closer to. It kind of mirrored that affect. The next album is, they're all married. You know, most of them are married. They have two of them have kids. So they're kind of happy in where they are, and reflective. The last album they do together, when the I think it's the lead singer and the drummer are no longer speaking to each other is much more metal and angry. I don't think that one did that well because, you know, you've got to work as a team.
Sure, yeah. It's tough to make music when you're all in separate rooms.
Yeah, so I think that... so they especially are a band, you can see the growth real quickly. You see in other bands as they get older, Blink's a good example of that, where you see them kind of grow a little bit over the course of, like, what, they have, like, 40 albums, right, I think?
About, yeah. <too. laughs> Also a band that spent an album, like, not being in the same room as each other.
Yeah, but you can see Stained go through this progression of, like, pissed, angry, and, you know, the world is fucked, to kind of accept happiness and reflecting, and then, you know, back to where they were.
Cool. I mean, I definitely didn't know any of that about Stain, so thank you. Anything else? I mean, I think you've covered it, but anything else to say about It's Been a While?
I like the song, but I think I would rather listen to Lady Marmalade.
Our final admission, I'm going to say, might be the most contentious you'll ever hear me get with a guest. Eminem's The Real Slim Shady.
I'm Slim Shady, yes, I'm the real Shady. All you other Slim Shadys are just imitating. So won't the real Slim Shady please stand up? Please stand up.
So I didn't like Eminem then. Don't like Eminem now. Understood his place was important, and he was very of his time. So I added this to the admissions. I think it holds up horrendously, like worse than it was. Even then, it didn't do anything for me. I think it's embarrassing now. But go ahead. You can have the floor here for a bit.
First of all, Kathy Griffith, right in the beginning of the video.
Yes.
So there's your D-list celebrity. Not to mention Fred Durst is actually in the video.
Yeah, that tells you exactly how of the time this is.
When referenced.
Not to mention the Tom Green reference.
Yeah, which I'm sure almost no younger people will know who on earth that is.
Nope.
I wasn't into Eminem's first album, and I wasn't really into hip hop until later on, like end of high school into college. But coming back and listening to Eminem after I learned what real hip hop was, and not listening to the garbage that was playing on Z100 all the time, you know, after listening to things like Black Star and Mos Def and Immortal Technique and Common Sense, you start to get appreciation of, like, what flow is supposed to sound like, and when you go to Jay-Z's Blueprint and things like that, and then you go to I started listening to Eminem because my cousin was really into him, probably just because he was like another angry white guy, and my cousin's kind of a nutbag. I started listening and, like, well, the first album was okay. This is kind of funny and hokey. But the Marshall Mathers LP, it has some good stuff on it, and for someone like me, you can appreciate it. Okay, Eminem, like you said, he's important, I guess. He did some good things, I guess. Opening people's eyes to some of these things is fine. Sure, maybe his lyrics were really caustic and, like, really, really rude. That's fine, too. But some of the stuff he says is, like, why can't a man and another man elope? Like, that's, to this day, it's still an issue. Isn't that a bummer?
Yes, but on the other hand, he's comparing it to Tom Green humping a dead animal, so he's not really saying it in any good faith.
Well, that's also in the same, like, bar as talking about Christina Aguilera between Fred Durst and Carson Daly and Who Blew Who. But he's just, I mean, he flips between lashing out and saying something real so quickly, it's hard to take him seriously. Which I think is, which makes it, some of the things he says easier to swallow. Like the man another man, why can't another man and a man elope? It's in between these two vitriolic phrases and offensive things to say, and you're distracted by all the other horrifying things that he says and how fast he says them, because he rips on everyone in this song, especially boy bands, Christina Aguilera, who badmouthed him, Britney Spears, he didn't like, Carson Daly, who thinks he's fake,
right?
The media, the Grammys companies, in general, the Grammys, yeah, everything. He makes fun of everything so much that you miss the things that he's kind of ahead of his time with. And even, you know, like you said, he drops the F-bomb for gay people enough where it seemed as offensive when you really see the actual views. He's flawed and not great, but at least he's self-aware and owns it. And he did a good job owning it, too, because to this Adele finally surpassed Mathers LP as the fastest selling hip album, period.
Wow.
Maybe he was not everyone's cup of tea, but he was a lot of people's cup of tea.
You know who has the most subscribers on YouTube?
Is that PewDiePie anymore, is it?
That is PewDiePie. Yeah, that guy, PewDiePie, you know, he's really good at being like a YouTube celebrity.
All right, I see where this is going.
He's just this kind of acerbic, loud, catering to like 14-year-old edgelords kind of thing. And I feel like 15 years later, that is like, that has completely like directed what Eminem actually was. Like, he was the WWF Attitude Era of music. Like, there was some really good wrestling there because they had like The Rock and Kurt Angle. There was a whole lot of shit, but most of the stuff that they got their ratings and their publicity for was like weird, edgy, dumb shit. Eminem is not bad his entire career. I wish he was more serious more often. He can rap. Rap God is proof of that. That song is great. I kind of like 8 Mile and that album too. I wish he did more serious stuff, less like, I'm going to own the angry young white dude thing, except he's not owning it at all, and it doesn't age well.
Yeah, I think the next year he does 8 Mile, and he starts to change. He was still kind of playing a character, and when I was younger, especially when he first came out and I was still a child, it was hard for me, because hip-hop at this point was always, it was the person, like, I am me, like, I'm Jay-Z, I'm Dre, I'm Mystical, you know, you're not playing a character. It didn't dawn on me that Eminem is playing Marshall Mathers is playing a character Eminem up until after hearing this, and it was, you know, mind blowing. And then it was because of Eminem that I could stomach Nicki Minaj today because of the character switching.
Makes sense. And he is definitely playing a character again. I think it's a really good comparison in that same way that like Felix Klugberg or whatever is not like PewDiePie off camera all the time. Like, there's parts of him in there. It's like his real personality turned up to 11. And like Stone Cold isn't him when he goes home all the time, you know? It's just a character that I don't like.
That's a good one. Yeah. You could not like, the jester.
Also, I don't like PewDiePie. Let's just put that fucking out there.
Yeah, I get that too.
He's just relevant in the news right now because some people think he's a Nazi.
Yeah, Eminem was I agree with you that his serious stuff, and when he gets to, I don't want to say real, but he takes off this mask, I like him a lot better. Lose Yourself might be one of my favorite songs that he's ever done. Like you said, Rap God, brilliant. Even not Kim, Stan. Stan is a great song that he does without they use Dido's example, Dido. And it's about, you know, the guy, his fan.
I think it's still a little edgelordy.
Sure, maybe. But it was on this album. And even then, he took that more seriously than he did. It shows that his ability to be a better rapper, just using Dido and that situation. When he does stuff like that, it's a little bit better.
Was Dre doing all of his production?
I want to say he did. Because he was on Dre's album. This was the first one released on the Shim City album. He was given a label, Slim Shady Albums. I think the first one, Dre did everything for him. I think he still used a lot of Dre. I think Dre did most of them, especially the real Slim Shady. I know Dre did because there's more beat instead of overproduction because Eminem has like really good flow and he can really lyrically bite. So when Dre wants to do that, he will take out overproduction, just give a beat for the guy to talk to. And that's what this is, more or less.
If there's one thing that I would say is like top quality about this song, it's, and a lot of Eminem stuff, production is always really good. I also really like his verse. And again, the production on this song of Forgot About Dre. That's another Eminem song I love, and that has some top-notch production on it as well.
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, love him or hate him, and that's fine. Like, you don't have to like him all the time, but he's... I learned to like him. Not like you would learn to like a boil that you just can't get rid of off your foot, but you learn to like a flaw of yourself, that you just kind of grow with. He may not be the best of what hip-hop was or could be, what he was, but he's kind of grown to something that, you know, hip-hop, he's part of it. And nowadays, a good one. He's got something new coming up the pipeline now. I think he just had a verse on someone's album, song, where he just trashes our current president.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, you have to get noticed somehow when most of your fans have grown up.
Sure, but I mean, also, he comes from a very poor neighborhood.
Oh, well, sure, yeah. I mean, Michigan, Republicans have not been kind to parts of Michigan.
Mm-mm. No, especially, you know, you can't even drink the water.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, that's my thoughts on Eminem. I like him a lot. But like I said, I grew to like him. I didn't at first, but I grew to like him.
Right, and I think, you know, he's going to be an artist who your opinion of him is totally going to hinge on how you felt about him at a young age. And I think that's important. I mean, that's part of what this podcast is about. And we've always said it's okay to like things, but it's also okay to not like things. And I think that's it's a worthy discussion. I would love to hear what more people actually thought about Eminem, especially if they go back and revisit him as an adult. So right into the mailbag. But that's now volume 7. Well, we're not done. Normally, we would do Rap Genius, and this is going to take the place of the Rap Genius segment. I done graduated from Versace Junior College. But we're going to do something a little different, and Joe actually doesn't know that this is coming.
Oh, my goodness.
So after Jay-Z and R. Kelly did their album and they toured together, there was a massive lawsuit between them. And I was able to find the legal complaint against R. Kelly. And it is incredible. So I've reduced it down, not quite to the cliff notes. It's kind of a tragedy in about 6 parts. We're going to do an audiobook for you where we...
Oh my goodness, we're going to, this is amazing.
We're going to read Jay-Z's legal document against R. Kelly, what he's suing for damages for. It's condensed and the full one will be in the show notes. I've taken maybe a few dramatic liberties here and there.
A dramatic reading of the Jay-Z R. Kelly tour lawsuit. The audience's tremendous response to a duet performance by Jay-Z and R. Kelly reignited discussions of a possible tour collaboration. Intermittent discussions continued until the summer of 2004, when Jay-Z and R. Kelly agreed to record a second album. In the course of those discussions, R. Kelly's representatives represented to Jay-Z that R. Kelly could and would deliver a first-class performance at each concert. In negotiating acceptable financial terms, R. Kelly told Jay-Z and his representatives that he desperately needed money and he would require substantial compensation to participate. He reiterated his precarious financial and legal circumstances.
Jay-Z and R. Kelly agreed to meet in Chicago approximately 10 days before the tour's start for the specific purpose of reviewing material for the show and rehearsing. Jay-Z arrived timely, but R. Kelly's whereabouts were unknown. When he finally materialized several days later, insufficient time remained to rehearse adequately. Because of R. Kelly's absence, rehearsals were initially canceled, leaving only 3 production days to squeeze in rehearsals and to complete tasks normally requiring considerable amounts of time. During the first of those 3 remaining days, Jay-Z scheduled a rehearsal with R. Kelly. Although Jay-Z appeared for the rehearsal, R. Kelly was late by more than 2 hours, and then he squandered the remaining time by playing basketball. Consequently, no meaningful rehearsal occurred that day, let alone during the remaining days. There are some great little flourishes of dramatic prose that Jay-Z's lawyer threw in there throughout this that are not edited at all.
No meaningful rehearsal occurred that day, let alone the remaining days.
It's perfect.
So what I'm getting from this right now is R. Kelly is the Allen Iverson of rehearsals.
Yes,
it's practice.
Perfect.
On the last scheduled rehearsal day, R. Kelly panicked, motivating him to attempt to rehearse. However, he spent considerable time laboring over innocuous issues pertaining to his sexually laden skits, which prevented him from attending important rehearsals with the lighting director, Jay-Z, the dancers, and other critical aspects of the show. R. Kelly concentrating his time on a simulated sex skit involving a menage a trois inside a cage.
Of course.
R. Kelly also rehearsed the skit involving simulated sex text messaging with a female audience member. The skit concerned the audience member's age, inappropriate prompting reminders of R. Kelly's criminal matter involving an underage girl. R. Kelly belatedly hired a firm to create additional video, but the finished product was delivered late.
The first concert went as well as expected given the circumstances of R. Kelly's defaults and misconducts. The Chicago crowd responded enthusiastically to Jay-Z's performance. R. Kelly's performance was noticeably mediocre, as it reflected his lack of preparation and rehearsal. Throughout his hometown performance, R. Kelly appeared uneasy and lethargic. The media decried R. Kelly's inclusion of the sexually laden skits, viewing them as inappropriate and callous in light of the pending felony charges. The public's reaction forced R. Kelly to remove the skits and intensified R. Kelly's sullen and unenthusiastic attitude about the tour.
For the second Chicago concert, the performers were directed to arrive by 7 p.m. Jay-Z timely arrived. However, R. Kelly was inexplicably absent. He arrived after 8:15 but refused to leave his tour bus. R. Kelly's representatives would not approach or even telephone him while he was in the bus. Jay-Z was informed that only R. Kelly refused to exit the bus. Unbeknownst to Jay-Z and the promoter, R. Kelly was waiting for his personal technician to deliver his reprogrammed vocals. After more than an hour and a half delay, concertgoers became unruly and violent. The police threatened to employ a riot squad to prevent further violence, believing the concert would be canceled because of R. Kelly's absence. At approximately 10 p.m., Kelly exited the bus. Since R. Kelly substantially modified his show without coordinating with anyone else, snags arose in his performance. Appearing frustrated and depressed, R. Kelly abandoned the concert before its end, leaving Jay-Z on stage to perform the grand finale alone.
Due to R. Kelly's unexpected and disruptive delay, the next scheduled concert in Cincinnati, Ohio, was canceled because it was logistically impossible to travel there and set up in time. Ticket holders were provided less than 24-hour notice of the cancellation. The last-minute cancellation was embarrassing to the tour and damaging to Jay-Z's reputation. R. Kelly's conduct impacted box office receipts, thus preventing Jay-Z from increased earnings. In Columbus, Ohio, Jay-Z called a meeting with R. Kelly to discuss Jay-Z's distress and dissatisfaction with R. Kelly's general attitude, conduct, and performances. R. Kelly explained that he was dissatisfied with the lighting direction. In Baltimore, Maryland, R. Kelly sat down with the members of the tour to review concert footage so that he could air his complaints. Displeased to hear that he was the source of his own problems, R. Kelly verbally exploded, hurling objects and shouting that he was going home. He abruptly left the meeting, seeking sanctuary in his tour bus.
I like the way you read that. I'm going home. That was the right way to read that.
You know, you have to be kind of petulant.
Kind of petulant. This is Jay-Z's concern about your performance, your attitude, and your conduct. But R. Kelly was only concerned about
the
lighting.
This is Jay-Z's side of the story, so of course he's going to look like a fucking angel. It multiple times points out that he was timely throughout this.
Yeah, well, yes, yeah. R. Kelly's violent outburst occurred before the start of the sold-out Baltimore concert, which he had delayed for more than an hour and a half. With the Chicago incident still fresh in mind, the promoter and others were concerned that the audience members would become violent. A Park fan blocked R. Kelly from leaving the venue, enabling the promoter to speak with R. Kelly, who by then was a weeping, emotional wreck. I'm sure that's entirely true. The promoter and Jay-Z were informed that R. Kelly would abandon the tour if his demands were not met. R. Kelly ultimately backed down, agreeing to perform. He held the tour. This man, this is amazing. I love Jay-Z's entire take on this.
We're at the third act here. R. Kelly's next battleground was St. Louis. R. Kelly added a skit in which R. Kelly appeared to strip in silhouette to the song, Strip For You, while a group of dancers sauntered on stage carrying the removed clothing. R. Kelly then emerged from behind the screen wearing a trench coat. At the end of the song, R. Kelly appeared opening his coat so as to flash the audience. At the moment, the lights went black. Unfortunately, an unintended miscue arose that caused the light to go black at the wrong moment. R. Kelly left the stage in a rage. Without explanation or apology, R. Kelly returned to the stage, bowed to the audience, changed his outfit, and left the venue before the concert was completed. The entire incident appeared on video screens in the arena. R. Kelly then went to a local McDonald's where he began serving food to the patrons at the drive-thru.
Get the fuck out of town! It's not real! There's no way!
Weird Al, I know he did a parody of Trapped in the Closet called Trapped in the Drive-Thru, and I've never heard it, but I have to wonder if it's actually a reference to this.
Oh my goodness, that's so you can tell R. Kelly is the kind of performer where consistency is not a big deal. You got to have one big act, and that's what people remember. You know, like that's clearly what is all about. That's what his whole performance thing is about. That's wow.
Yeah. Okay. He probably doesn't need. He's probably good enough to not need to do all of that live. He probably thinks it like adds, but clearly just adds problems to the show.
I wonder if he just likes. He might have just reacted to not being the one in control of everything.
Yeah.
You know, this is a kind of like escape and like no fuck you kind of thing. I don't know. But serving at the McDonald's drive-thru, that is. You could either be stripping at a club or serving at a drive-thru. I mean, both of these were likely. God,
that's fucking art. You are finishing it up, sir. This is Shakespeare's Act 5 of the R. Kelly Jay-Z tour lawsuit document.
After the concert, R. Kelly renewed his threat to cancel the tour. He demanded that concerts in Milwaukee and Hartford be canceled so he could rehearse for upcoming concert at Madison Square Garden. On October 29th, 2004, Jay-Z and R. Kelly appeared at the Garden for the first of three scheduled concerts. However, that evening became R. Kelly's final curtain call. Stating that he observed two men brandishing firearms, R. Kelly announced to the audience he would not continue this performance. He threw his mic on the ground and exited the stage while crying hysterically. Although a search was conducted, no weapons were found in the arena. By that time, concert goers were raucous and impatient. Recognizing that R. Kelly was not returning, Jay-Z appeared on stage and announced to the audience that if they indulged him, he would put together a show. Jay-Z left the stage and within a short time enlisted a number of well-known performers who were present that evening in the audience or as guests of the artist to perform. The show was one of the most historic events in music of all time.
Yeah, the lawyer definitely does say that the show was one of the most historic events in music.
That's an actual word. That's wonderful.
I love him painting Jay-Z as this guy. I mean, that probably did. They would have to prove that happened. I'm sure there's a video of it somewhere. Like, he probably did get people and, like, try to throw together a performance. And that's pretty fucking cool. But, like, this thing does paint him as, like, tour bus Jesus.
So this was 2004, right? So he was probably promoting the Blueprint album. And you know, at that time, you know, Nas is not going to show up because they're still not friends. But, you know, Jay-Z has quite the following, and New York has quite the huge rap scene. So if I was there for that, that'd be amazing.
Let's hear it from New York. Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. That's something else. But this is a wonderful. I don't think I want to see R. Kelly's side of this. I think this just knowing this just feeds into how amazing R. Kelly is as a personality, and I don't want this to change.
It's like so when they made the movie Rudy, they went and talked to like the coach, and they make the coach a lot like more of a bad guy than he actually is.
The second coach, right?
Yeah, the one who like doesn't want to play him. That actually didn't happen in real life. But the coach was the coach loved like the real coach loved the real Rudy so much he was just like, yeah, fuck it, I'll be the bad guy in this movie. I'm retired, I don't give a shit. And he just allowed it to happen. Like, that's how I hope this is forever. Like, R. Kelly is just like, yeah, I cried like a bitch all the time in the tour bus.
Yeah, I'm emotional. I did it. It wasn't my scene. I didn't want to do it that way. This is all the things I'd expect from my, like, my 16-year-old nephew to ramble and be like, no, I don't want it because of this. Or, you know, some of my students will get really fixated on how one thing is, like, slightly off. So everything gets trashed. It's like, guys, come on. Big picture here.
Oh, man. Well, I hope that the listeners enjoyed our dramatic reading of our Shakespearean tragedy of the Jay-Z and R. Kelly tour. Yeah. If something like this comes up again, maybe like someone on the Now writes a terrible autobiography or something like that, maybe we'll...
I hope you can tell I used to be an elementary teacher and read books to kids.
It's time for the recommendation section.
So I did do some digging because I don't remember exactly what came out because, you know, everything's a big blur. But I can let you know, in September of this year, the GameCube was released.
Oh, shit.
So, Mario Kart Double Dash.
A great system with a terrible controller.
I hate that controller. It's the worst. I don't know why people prefer it so much. I dislike it with all my heart.
It is absolutely terrible.
And if I had to make one concrete suggestion, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Well, this has been Now and Again, and that was Joe. We're never talking to him again. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back is, so I was a fan because of Kevin Smith, but that's, I mean, I don't like all of his movies, just some of them. I like the way he paced, the way, how fast dialogue goes. It's a funny, silly movie.
When's the last time you saw it?
Ooh, maybe 2 years ago?
Wow, okay.
So, no, you know, when it comes to me and movies, just like me and music, I like it until I don't. And this is one of those things where I just still like it. Mark Hamill's in it playing Cockknocker. Carrie Fisher is a nun who Jay goes down on. Come on, guys. Let's get a consensus for what's offensive and what's wonderful.
So you did like Eminem, right?
I did.
Remind me. Okay, I just couldn't remember for a second. Okay, well, I'm going to recommend an actual good movie that people should watch. And hey, it's okay to like things. If you like Kevin Smith, you're just wrong. 2001.
I don't like Kevin Smith. I like this. This is a fun movie.
It's definitely, you know, less serious than a lot of his other stuff, which is good because when he tries to be serious, it's embarrassing. Chasing Amy, Jersey Girl.
Chasing Amy was garbage. Yeah. Just garbage. I can agree with you on that one.
Yeah, he should stick with being funny. But then again, Clerks 2 was a complete piece of shit too. So I don't know. He's so hit and miss and mostly miss, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's probably true. I mean, he's from New Jersey. He can't get everything right.
No, New Jersey only had enough, like, always correct for one person, and they gave it all to Bruce.
They did. He was, and he just, he'll never die. I hope he never, never dies.
Same.
Because after that, what's left, man? Like, Bon Jovi? Yeah. Come on. He's basically a Philadelphia resident now.
2001 did have a lot of incredible movies.
I was looking specifically at this one. So if we're looking at August of 2001, August, September 2001, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, of the movies that came out, that's the one I really liked the most. So I picked it to that exact time. And Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back coming out right when September 11th happened, I think maybe that's why I gravitate towards it harder, because it's quite the, you can kind of get away from the tone of what was happening.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So you can, Jane's Up Upside Back, there's almost nothing serious in it at all. Everything was so serious at this time. Our whole world came crashing down, literally, over the course of 5 hours of one morning. To see this movie that came out and totally, without Kevin Smith knowing it, made something that you can just kind of retreat into way and laugh at these characters he's been building for years. You know, that's what made it kind of stick with me. Even if it doesn't hold up to nowadays, it's really... if you're really bummed out about how serious shit is happening, especially with today's issues, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back is a good place to retreat to. Not the best, but it's from right then, it was a good one.
That's fair. That's completely fair. But yeah, 2001, a great year for movies. Just to throw a couple, I feel like I got to back pocket one of these just in case I need one for the other 2001 recommendations. But Spirited Away comes out this year.
Y
Tu Mama Tambien comes out this year, and we're all going to know the name Alfonso Cuarón in a couple of years, which is real nice. You know, he's incredible.
Spirited Away,
now.
That's your benchmark for movies. Spirited Away.
Also got Ghost World, Amelie, Royal Tenenbaums, good year for indie film and foreign film. But the one I'm going to recommend, it was not like, you know, the biggest film of the year. Didn't win Best Picture. That was A Beautiful Mind, which, I mean, it's not the worst movie. You've also got, like, Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter franchises starting up. A lot of, you know, 2001 is really a big benchmark for film. But the movie I'm going to recommend is one of my favorite films of all time, Mulholland Drive. David Lynch is amazing. He's one of the greatest auteurs of all time. Mulholland Drive is an incredible piece of work, especially considering it was initially filmed as, like, two or three episodes of a TV show that got canceled, and then he edited it together into a movie, since he wanted to do something with the footage. And just what came out is one of the greatest films of the 2000s, and I mean, certainly in the conversation of all time. I know the new They Shoot Pictures Don't They list came out this year. It updates every year, and Mulholland Drive is in like the top 300, which I think is a place where it super deserves to be. You've got Naomi Watts in her star-making performance, and the scene where she does her audition is just breathtaking and incredible. It's got one of the scariest, multiple probably, scenes that up there in the scariest scenes of all time. Mulholland Drive is perfect. If you like David Lynch, you've probably seen it already. If you don't think you really like David Lynch, this is probably the one that's the most accessible of all of his works. And it should be seen by anyone who just likes film. Mulholland Drive is borderline perfect.
Yeah, that's great. But Spirited Away, that's a good one. And I'll have to look into Mulholland Drive because I know you've mentioned it before, but I've never heard of it.
David Lynch movies are tough to parse. They require like full attention.
That's how I watch my movies.
When I say that David Lynch movies are scary, they're not like booga 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 scary. Like they wouldn't be something to play the Joe game to. They're just they're really unsettling, and they draw on like people's deeper fears and like things that just in this very like abstract way,
like Babadook did.
Even more abstract than that, like that you can still kind of say like that's a movie about like trauma, and like being able to move past it. Like Mulholland Drive is just a hard movie to figure out what it's even about, but you certainly don't mind trying.
I'll do that. Oh, that's a good one.
It is a good one.
You definitely don't have to watch James the Bob Strike Back.
I definitely won't. Thanks again to Joe for stopping by the show. With the Joe trilogy complete, we can now start the prequel trilogy, where we like CGI them into songs that they shouldn't normally be in. You are absolutely going to love the episode with the Padres. Quick admin stuff, at Now Again Pod on Twitter, at Cage Club Pod on Twitter. There's a new show, P.S. I Love Hoffman. It's all about the movies of Philip Seymour Hoffman. You know there's going to be some real quality and also Twister in there. Facebook, mailbag, rate, review, follow, all of that cool stuff on iTunes. We will see you as always on the flip side.